how do we emotionally process the dramatic impact of rising sea levels on our communities?
And so I think sort of dwelling in that space of uncertainty is actually a really important first step to opening our eyes to the incredible scale of these changes. They will change us, whether we want them to or not. And I think our coastal communities know that well already, and we're only at the very beginning.
That's Elizabeth Rush. We talk with her about her beautifully written book, Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore. Then, a judge just ruled that two major California cities cannot sue fossil fuel companies to recover the costs of dealing with sea level rise. We'll air some clips about the case from our December interview with Lynn Zinser of Climate Liability News. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. We live in a time when it's becoming clear that climate change is neither imagined nor distant, and that rising seas are transforming the coastline of the U.S. in irrevocable ways. In her book, Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore, Elizabeth Rush takes readers to some of the places where this change has been most dramatic, from the Gulf Coast to Miami, and from New York City to the Bay Area. For many of the plants, animals, and humans in these places, the options are stark: retreat or perish in place. Weaving firsthand accounts from those facing this choice with profiles of wildlife biologists and activists, Rising brings us the voices of those usually kept at the margins. The book is a meditation on vulnerable communities, both human and other than human, and on how to let go of the places we love. Elizabeth Rush teaches creative nonfiction at Brown University in Rhode Island. Well, Elizabeth Rush, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
This book, this wonderful book, Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore, it's a book that's told in remarkable personal stories, including your own. You teach creative nonfiction, and this is a book that in many ways embodies, I think, all the best of that genre. And that includes, you know, it's almost as in sociology, they talk about participant observing. Well, this is participant writing. Talk about creative nonfiction.
Well, it's this amazing genre, and I should start by saying that in many ways, I started as a poet. I studied poetry in college. I wrote a poetry thesis, a collection of lyric poems, and pretty soon after graduating, moved to Vietnam and kept writing poems, sold my first poem for $35, and quickly realized that poetry itself probably wouldn't pay the bills. And so I started to turn to journalism to make ends meet while living abroad and sort of freshly graduated. And so I would do these long journalistic pieces on the completion of the India-Bangladesh border fence or on the underground art scene in Myanmar. And that was very practical. It helped me pay my bills. And I started to write about sea level rise about half a decade ago in this way, sort of with a journalistic point of view. So a lot of in-person interviewing and fact-based reporting. And yet I started to feel like something was missing, that in relaying those facts, I sort of had also somehow missed out on conveying to my readers the experience of what it's like to actually be in one of these communities that's slowly coming undone as tides rise and storms get stronger. And I realized one way to begin to convey that emotion, again, of sitting with someone and listening to them describe their house being lost, was for me to put myself in that scene and sort of own a slightly more subjective perspective, and also to lean into lyricism and think about how I could have words on the page in and of themselves have a sort of like incantation and beauty to them, to also maybe make climate change into something other than just a series of facts that is devastating and scary. And so I think all of those things, what I was really doing was finding my way to this genre, creative nonfiction, which for me is very much a hybrid between poetry and journalism.
So, Elizabeth Rush, you begin with a salt marsh in Rhode Island, where you live right now. You teach at Brown. You teach creative nonfiction there. You're contemplating a drowned tupelo tree. Tell us about that tree.
So I'm contemplating this drowned tupelo tree, and its form is incredibly skeletal. So you see these trees, and if you live somewhere along the coast, if you go to your nearest saltwater marsh, you'll probably see something similar. All along the coast, a lot of our hardwoods that are right at sort of the upland edge of our saltwater marshes are starting to die in place. And that's a result of rising seas. To get really specific about the science, I talked to a scientist who studies cypress death in Louisiana, and you certainly see they're sort of like bone trees. They're trees without any leaves, completely skeletal. They've died in place because of the saline in the soil. And he said it's actually a very particular set of circumstances that will lead a tree to die in one of these situations. So a lot of times the trees along our coast are adapted to living with a little bit of salt water. And what we're witnessing more and more is two things. Sometimes the tree's taproot starts to work its way into an aquifer that started to have saline inundation in it. And so the root systems suck up slightly more salinated water than the tree is prepared to handle, and it'll die. Another thing that can often happen is with these stronger storms, you have trees getting big dumps of salt water on them during these storm events that never used to experience that intensity of salt water ever. And especially if they go into the storm water hungry, if there's been a drought leading up to the storm, the tree just sucks up all that water. And an instance like that can kill a tree very quickly. So you kind of have these two different things happening, saline inundation in the aquifer, and then also stronger storms that dump more standing water in and around the root systems. And if a tree is stressed, it sucks it up and often dies. So the book opens with me going to visit this salt marsh in Rhode Island that is, you know, has at least half a dozen of these ghost trees along its periphery. And they're really something that I started to notice in every single coastal community I visited. Everywhere I went, I would see another, you know, two dozen, hundred hardwood trees that were dead because of saline inundation. And they become this marker, I think, of the moment that the salt water really started to work its way in. And for me, it's important because I think sea level rise is really hard for us to see. It's a hard phenomenon to keep track of. It's incremental. It's slow moving. Yeah, we have sunny day flooding where you, in certain very low-lying areas, you get a little bit of like salt water burbling up through the storm drains. But it's in many ways hard to witness. And these trees themselves, if we can learn to see them and learn to understand what they symbolize, to me are one of the biggest visual markers of rising seas.
Yes, and you also use it as a metaphor. I guess the technical term for trees like this is rampikes, but you expand that into a metaphor. You say that they're a kind of memorial.
That's true. And in part, I was absolutely inspired by this landscape architect team called Azimuth Landcraft. Out of nowhere, they won a design competition. It must have been like 2 years ago now, run by the National Park Service to design a memorial, a new memorial for Washington, D.C. And they proposed to put in at the farthest tip of Hunts Point, which is sort of the Long Island that runs out from the Jefferson Memorial, they came up with a design plan to put in a graded field of cherry blossom trees that of cherry trees that would, as sea levels continue to rise, die one by one. And row after row. If you go, I went out to Hunts Point to see where they proposed to site this memorial. They called it a memorial for the future. And it's true that the tip of that long landmass is already underwater during the highest tides, and it never used to be. And so it's very easy to imagine then, you know, putting in 150 cherry trees and using this as a place for people to reflect on the future that we continue to construct together, and how it's really fundamentally changing the world that we live in now. So I do think of these trees as a kind of memorial, and I started seeing them before I found this design team, but my conversations with them helped me really understand what it symbolized, I think, for all of us, and how important it was, I thought, for us to learn to be able to see and experience these rampikes that really line our coasts already.
That's so powerful. You also, as you say, you also put a fair amount of science into this book, not difficult science, but science that informs, you know, really the poetry of what you're seeing. You say that over the last 200 years, Rhode Island has lost over 50% of its tidal marshes. I want to ask how that happened, and also why, when in the past salt marshes could migrate, they can't do that now.
So, I mean, it's Rhode Island, but it's also, I'm not going to list them. It's the overwhelming majority of the coastal states along the eastern seaboard have lost 50% or more of their tidal wetlands over the past 200 years, I'm sorry. And that's really a result of development. There was this very particular legislation in 1850 called the Swamp Lands Act that gave states the right to sell off their tidal wetlands if the purchaser could drain and dike and transform that land into arable land, into land that could be farmed or developed. And so up until that point, all tidal wetlands were considered federal property and the rights to them sort of held by all. If you dig back further in history, those wetlands belong to indigenous groups throughout the country. But there was this period where they were considered federal land. But then this act came into being that the idea was essentially to help states transform land that they needed into land where they could put people and increase farming, and at the same time also help make it taxable property so that they could then gather property taxes to fund the kinds of infrastructure projects that would help keep those lands functioning in the long term. In essence, that law came into being right around the time when Florida, I don't know if it was right before or right after Florida's statehood, but it's a big reason why we have that joke, you know, about swamplands in Florida. It also fundamentally transformed a lot of the estuary, the largest estuary on the West Coast in California. So there's this very particular legislation that also sort of opened the way to developing in our tidal wetlands. And then they just start to disappear really rapidly in different ways in different places. And what was the second part of your question?
Yeah, that in the past, if threatened by, say, sea level rise, salt marshes could actually migrate, but they can't do that anymore.
Yeah, so that was one of the things that most fascinated me while researching rising was that, you know, our seas have risen in the past and dropped in the past, and marshes tend to migrate with them, moving in and out. I liken it to the way desire follows the desired. It's a really incredible set of processes that allow marshes to sort of keep pace with rising sea levels. But the thing that they need in order to be able to migrate is space, you know, uphill, inland, to move up and in onto. So you have these, well, I'm not going to get it too deep into the science of it. But the thing that really impedes marsh migration in the present tense is the communities that we've built alongside our tidal wetlands. So that's causing something like, I think we call it marsh squeeze, where you have rising seas on one level and you might have a road or a bike path or a train line or a development at the backside of the marsh. And all of that development just means that the marsh, as sea levels rise, can't move up and in with them. And so they're starting to drown in place. And I had never walked on a salt marsh until I started writing this book. And I can tell you that a healthy salt marsh is a gorgeous thing to walk on. It's sort of firm underfoot. It's not too squelchy or muddy or like vaporous. But a marsh that's in trouble starts to turn kind of into, first it becomes very pocked, and then it'll often turn to a kind of jello under your feet. So if you're interested in, you know, exploring your nearest tidal marsh, it's pretty easy to tell which ones are healthy and which ones aren't. Just test out the ground beneath your feet and you'll know.
Well, I do have a salt marsh quite near to me. It is in Accabonic Harbor, and there is a group of people, myself included, who are trying to save it. And it really strikes me from your description right now that, yes, I know the exact demarcation line when I walk there, when I go from, you know, a place where I can comfortably walk to a place where my feet are going to be wet if I don't wear galoshes.
Yes, exactly. And that might be, I mean, that might be also a little bit the difference between high and low marsh. But in general, that like muddy, mucky, miasma-y feeling is usually a sign that there's some kind of barrier to the marsh migrating up and in, or there's some kind of tidal restriction and the water sitting too long on the marsh. And I mean, in layman's terms, it often means that it's starting to drown in place.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Elizabeth Rush about her stunning exploration of the vulnerable places we're losing to sea level rise. It's called Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore. Now, one place in which this process has gone far beyond, weakened marshes to marshes that are no longer there, is Île de Jean Charles in Louisiana. Talk about that community and what you found there.
So the Île de Jean Charles is, it's about an hour and a half south of New Orleans. And I first visited, I think it must have been about 2013. I had seen this film, Beasts of the Southern Wild, which the island is roughly based on. And if you haven't seen it, it's sort of this like magical, realist, indie epic about a group of mixed race people, indigenous and African American and French and Cajun, that all live in the drowning marshes of Louisiana. And there's a terrible storm that comes and they band together to weather the storm. And then the federal government comes in and essentially says, you know, we want you to leave. And their response is, no, we don't want to leave. And the storm itself brings them closer together. And I found that story surprisingly hopeful. And so I wanted to go see this community that the film was based on. So I got a tiny little advance for an article, and I drove out there and spent about a month on the island. And in the simplest terms, this island has lost about 95% of its land mass over the past 50 years. And that's for a number of reasons. Sea level rise is one of them, but you also have, it's situated in the Mississippi Delta, and the damming of the Mississippi has withheld really vital land replenishing silt behind all of the 29 different dams that are on the Mississippi. So just as sea levels are rising, you also have this silt that's really key to a wetland being able to keep pace with sea level rise not arriving because it's getting stuck behind the dams. And then you have a third factor, which is the oil industry. So there are oil rigs all around this island, and in order to increase ease of access to the rigs, the oil industry cut big channels through the wetlands that surround the oil rigs. And they were supposed to backfill them with rocks to keep the water moving through those channels more slowly and to slow the erosion, but they didn't do that. So you also have all of these cuts through the marsh that then increase erosion and land loss. So it's sort of like this triple effect happening. So I went out to this island, and in truth, at the time, I was in the process of leaving my fiance, and the people who I found out there, despite their living under really difficult circumstances, you know, where their land would flood regularly, where they'd lost their capacity to have cows and to farm, they were, you know, people in a very stressed situation, and yet they took incredible care of me. They cooked me dinner and, you know, welcomed me into their homes. So it was true that I found this group that had become really tight in part through the process of weathering these storms, and they extended that hospitality towards me. It was really a profound experience. And I thought that they were going to stay in place, even while that place was sort of changing irrevocably all around them. And years passed, I stayed in touch with one person in particular, a guy named Chris Brunet, and gosh, it must have been 2 years ago now, or a year and a half ago. I opened up the New York Times one day, and there was the headline, "The First Climate Change Refugees in the United States." And it was a picture of the island. And they had won a $54 million grant through HUD to relocate in as a group. And so I immediately called Chris, and I said, "Is it true? Are you going?" And he said, "I am. You know, I see anytime you're in a difficult place, the more options you have, the more choices you have, the better. And we've been in this difficult place for a really long time. And this is the best option that has ever come along. So I'm going to take it." And so I went back out to the island and visited again with all the people that I had met out there. And, you know, not everyone is ready to leave. And I, as much as I am a firm believer that retreat is something that we have to get more comfortable with, and it's one of the few things that can really make space for those marshes to migrate inland and to help give the potential to move up and into sort of all wetland, tidal wetland species, I also have to honor the fact that I don't have the power to come in and tell someone to leave their home, that that's a choice that they have to make on their own terms. So most of the islanders are leaving, but some are staying put for now.
Yeah, and what was something that really stayed with me when you talked about that, you say that a community is a kind of organism. And so with more people, recovery from storms is faster, but with fewer, the organism falls apart. And that on the one hand, that's one thing that happened there, and also on the other, that those who are leaving are actually hoping to reestablish their community, including people who left a long time ago. Talk about that.
Yeah, so the Isle de Jean Charles won this, it's another sort of design competition called the Disaster Resiliency Competition, and the idea was, the reason that they got this funding was because HUD wanted to experiment with what it looks like to relocate a community in advance of a devastating storm. So they know that the Isle de Jean Charles gets hammered, and they didn't want to wait for another Katrina until they started to think about what relocation might look like. So that was one thing they wanted to experiment with. And the other, and I think it's in particular, like, especially useful in this context, is how do you maintain and keep that community intact even as they move in? So the residents of the Isle de Jean Charles are a mixture of three indigenous groups, Biloxi, Chitimacha, and Choctaw. And they also have French and Cajun lineage as well, and Acadian. So they have this mixed lineage, and they're a very particular group of people. And so the federal government deemed it important to think of keeping them together as a group. So they've found land. It's about 50 miles inland. They are required by law to move out of the floodplain. And in Louisiana, that actually means moving up and in quite a bit. They recently purchased the land. They've been part of the design process. So the architects who are building their new homes have come out to the island multiple times and are asking, you know, what are things that are important to you? How would you know that? What are the things that will make you feel at home? Something that I think is really, how would I put it? A profound insight was how important fishing was to the folks on the island. So they are putting in a pond in the new community for fishing. It's not, I mean, many islanders will complain and say, you know, fishing in a stocked puddle ain't fishing, but it is a step towards acknowledging how important that activity is. So relocation of entire groups of people is incredibly complicated. Finding the space to relocate people is really difficult. Thinking about what are the things that make a community above and beyond the residents is another sort of set of important questions. And the Isle de Jean Charles is one of the first places that I think we're really trying to address those questions now to see how we might start to think about implementing policies around buyout and relocation that can help communities stay intact as best as possible. One other place that was really interesting that I wrote about was a number of communities on the eastern shore of Staten Island after Hurricane Sandy. They came together and started to petition the state to purchase and demolish their flood-ruined homes. And the way that they dealt with sort of keeping the community intact or the possibility of keeping the community intact in Staten Island was to offer an additional bonus on the closing price of their houses. So the state agreed to purchase these homes and dismantle three communities along the shore in Staten Island. And they wanted to try to keep people in the area, in part because they wanted to maintain the property taxes. So they offered a 5% closing bonus on anyone who was going to take that money and then go take out a new mortgage within the five boroughs. And so many people relocated right inside of Staten Island, you know, a mile inland and up on a hill. So a lot of that community, those bonds amongst and between members is intact, even though they're not necessarily neighbors any longer. They still remain close to one another, a mile or 2 miles away. And they return to Oakwood on the weekends and also go fishing. So the constellation of their lives has shifted subtly, but it's not as profound as, you know, moving 50 miles inland. And that's in part just because you have topography that's more suited to that kind of relocation in New York.
Right. And in fact, you use a different metaphor than rampikes for these folks. You call them rhizomes. Why is that?
I call them rhizomes because thinking back to that question about marsh migration, marshes are able to migrate in part because they pull silt out of the water column. So thinking of why the Isle de Jean Charles is in trouble. You've got the silt that's being sort of trapped behind the various dams in the Mississippi River. So a lot of these coastal communities, if there's sand or silt in the water column, it'll brush up against the marsh grasses and settle down into the root system. And that allows marshes to gain ground. The other thing that lets them migrate up and in is that the overwhelming majority of marsh grasses have an underground root system that's rhizomatic. And essentially that means that instead of just sending roots down into the soil that sort of search for water and nutrients and filter nutrients back into the plant, the roots themselves can branch out underground beneath the plant. And they tend to be a little bit like risk adverse. So rhizomes, if they sense that the water is a little bit too salinated in one area, they'll start to grow in the opposite direction. They'll look for sort of the line of flight and grow in that direction. And then those roots can also sprout new shoots from them. So you have this underground process of sort of relocation where the rhizomes themselves are powering the marsh to retreat. And I found that that was really fascinating to realize that these marsh ecosystems could move away from risk, just as human beings are also having to learn to move away from risk.
Elizabeth Rush. We'll talk more about her book, Rising, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking to creative nonfiction writer Elizabeth Rush about her book, Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore. Just before the break, Rush was describing how a Staten Island community chose to retreat from the coastline after being devastated by Hurricane Sandy. Let's continue that conversation.
And the point that they do it themselves, you know, this is the, I believe in Oakwood, you know, and Staten Island is the only Republican borough. And these folks actually organized. They went and fought for this buyout. And you ask, how is it that they were interested in retreat? One of the most progressive and controversial adaptation strategies for sea level rise. So talk about that process that you discovered, that folks who, you know, belong to a party that doesn't even believe the sea level rise is happening or climate change is happening, were able to organize themselves to do the right thing.
It was an incredible thing to watch. I learned in the process of writing this book that, for instance, I might be really wedded to using the word climate change. And I think it's important that we acknowledge that climate change is happening and that humans are causing it. But that word is very much informed by a discourse that I believe in and that I'm steeped in. And I realized when I was talking with folks in Staten Island that maybe I needed to sort of leave my discourse at the door and start by asking them, you know, what has your experience with flooding been? How is your environment changing? And if I could check my discourse, the folks there are very quick to say, you know, we've been flooding worse and worse year after year. And a lot of folks in coastal communities in Staten Island are low to middle income. They're civil servants, they're sanitation workers, they're postal workers, they're telephone repairmen and women. And they certainly felt for years just at the bottom of the city's to-do list. So they've had this flooding problem. Many will point to the early 90s when it started to get worse. And they felt mistreated by the municipal government, that the government hadn't paid enough attention to their problem for two decades. When Sandy came, it's not like it was news to them. It was profound and devastating. You had more than half of the Sandy-related deaths took place along the eastern shore of Staten Island, many of which were on top of land that was formerly zoned as tidal marsh. A lot of that land was in many ways, I wouldn't exactly say illegally developed, but developed against a law that went into effect in 1973 that forbade the backfilling of coastal marshes. So you had politicians making a certain set of deals in order to allow developers to continue to develop in these places. Residents who had been there longer than that felt like the new development exacerbated flooding because the increased impervious services would lead to runoff and rain events and increased flooding in areas around the development. So it was a mix of lived experience and also feeling sort of regularly overlooked and disempowered. And so when Sandy came and all of New York City was reeling, those residents thought, we know this too well. And if we have 400,000 people underwater, we're going to be at the bottom of that list again. And they, I think, rightly feared that they would be living in sort of flood, ruined or warped homes or out of temporary FEMA housing for, you know, upwards of years after the storm if they decided they wanted to stay in place. So they started to come together especially around one man named Joseph Jerome. He heard about the possibility of a federal buyout and learned that they often sort of come from the top down. And he thought, you know what, if I can get everyone in my neighborhood to ask for it, we're going to have a better shot of securing those funds. And so he started this like door-to-door buyout campaign. I was just chatting with him the other day, and he was remembering how they actually made their own maps of the neighborhood. And you know, they went and they figured out every lot number, and they would go door to door explaining the possibility of a buyout, answering questions, really doing a kind of grassroots face-to-face advocacy that helped folks get on board with it. And one of the things that I found really interesting that he said came out through that process was that, again, thinking back to the socioeconomic makeup of the neighborhood, he said, you know, a lot of people were low to middle income, and if their homes were going to be demolished and turned into luxury condos, they weren't interested. So a buyout, as it's currently structured, demands that the land where the house stood that was purchased remain in open as open space in perpetuity. There is some discussion, and I think it's really misguided, to allow redevelopment on land that is part of federal flood buyouts. I won't get into that, but I'm part of a public campaign to sort of ask that FEMA not do that, because it's a really bad idea.
And what's the name of that campaign?
Well, it's a coalition of flood survivors around the country called Flood Forum USA. And they have a lot of different policy decision-making processes that they get involved in. But recently we were able to put, I think it's over 100 comments on the FEMA document that proposed this switch in the buyout policy. And that's now significantly slowed down the process, and FEMA's having to do a serious investigation of this policy switch.
100 comments or 100,000 comments?
100, which it went from 6 to 100 in like a day, thanks to this group. So I'm proud of that, and they're proud of that.
That's great, and we'll link to that on our website. You know, there's so much in your book we haven't had a chance to get to, so I can only urge my listeners to read this book, to read Rising. But before we go, I want to talk about maybe the deeper, more spiritual, more philosophical questions that you wrestle with, because I think we all do. You quote Wendell Berry, and he says, it's the destruction of the world in our own lives that drives us half insane and more than half to have lost wantonly the ancient forest, the vast grasslands, is our madness, the presence in our very bodies of our grief. And you also mentioned how your faith in natural processes is lost. And this sense of grief, I mean, I carry it with me every waking moment of every day. And I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, that Wendell Berry quote still gives me chills. I think that so many of us live with that great sense of grief every day, as you point to. And in some ways, I think that we put it aside. It's hard to encounter. There's a moment in the book where I'm swimming in the Gulf of Maine, and I grew up swimming in the Gulf of Maine. I think I grew up jumping into the Gulf of Maine and jumping right back out of the Gulf of Maine because it was so cold. And the Gulf of Maine is a body of water that's warming faster than almost any other body of water on the planet. And I feel it in my body when I swim there in the summer because I can swim. I can spend, you know, 20 minutes body surfing. And there's this incredible sensation of being pulled in two directions at once, of being deeply upset and anxious about how warm that water is. And at the same moment, still reveling in how absolutely gorgeous that body of water is and how amazing it feels to sort of be a body held aloft in that body of water. And I think in many ways, giving ourselves the space to dwell in that uncertainty, to not say, you know, either this is catastrophe or this is sheer bliss, but to not know what to do with that feeling, but to live with it and live inside of it and to welcome it into our lives, I think is actually a really profound and important first step in coming to terms with the fact of just how profoundly our planet is changing in ways that we don't want, in ways that there are ways in which we have little control over some of those changes. Of course, we're always participating in them in every moment, but there are also limits to what we can do at any one given moment. And so I think sort of dwelling in that space of uncertainty is actually a really important first step to opening our eyes to the incredible scale of these changes. They will change us whether we want them to or not. And I think our coastal communities know that well already, and we're only at the very beginning.
Well, your book is Rising, Dispatches from the New American Shore. Elizabeth Rush, it's been such a privilege to talk with you about this wonderful book.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, and thank you for your excellent questions.
Elizabeth Rush teaches creative nonfiction at Brown University. Her writing has appeared in Harper's, Orion, and The Washington Post, among others. Go to writersvoice.net to read some of her essays. You'll also find a link to that New York Times article she mentions about Isle de Jean Charles in Louisiana. In addition to Rising, Rush is the author of 5 other books. Next up, an update on a climate change lawsuit we covered in December. A ruling just came down this week. On June 25th, a federal judge threw out a lawsuit brought by San Francisco and Oakland against fossil fuel companies over the costs of dealing with climate change and sea level rise. They brought the suits under state public nuisance law, as we covered last December when we spoke with Lynn Zinser of Climate Liability News. Let's hear some clips from that interview talking about climate change lawsuits and then that case in particular.
Only 90 companies are responsible for half of all climate change. How long will it take before the world starts holding them accountable in court? Well, it's already happening. No suits have yet been won, but it took a long while before Big Tobacco started losing big in court, and many predict Big Dirty Energy will follow suit. Climate Liability News is the website to go to for reporting on the intersection of climate change impacts and the law. Like Inside Climate News, ProPublica, and Tarbell, it's a nonprofit journalism site. And I'm very pleased to welcome its founding editor, Lynn Zinser, to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
So, how much climate change litigation is happening in the U.S. and around the world now?
Well, it's still a relatively small group of suits, but it is certainly growing. And I think that a lot of people foresee more things on the horizon. Certainly, the cases that were filed by California communities this summer are very much a bellwether event, because what is going to be happening is as climate impacts become much harder to pay for as time goes along, they're getting more expensive, they're getting more common. Communities are having trouble figuring out how on earth this is going to get paid for. And the more cities that file suits such as that trying to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable, that certainly has to get attention of more communities across the country and around the world. So I would say it's still a relatively limited field, but it could change very quickly because as these costs escalate, there become fewer and fewer places to turn for how to pay for them.
Legal doctrines being used for these suits. I mean, we'll go into some particular ones, but maybe just give us a brief overview before we go into some examples.
Well, the one that gets the most attention right now is certainly the doctrine being pursued by Juliana versus the United States, the 21 kids suing the federal government for promoting fossil fuel policies that aggravate climate change, which they argue violates their right to life, liberty, and property in the future, and also a constitutional right, or they would like to see a constitutional right to a safe climate. That is based on a public trust doctrine, whereas, and it's really a legal doctrine that's not new, it's actually very, very old, that a government is responsible for preserving resources for, you know, for future generations' use, and in this case, resources being a livable climate and a safe environment. So that is the basis of that case. That is used in a lot of places around the world. And in many countries, they actually have constitutions that guarantee the health of their citizenry. Our constitution does not explicitly delineate that. So they're trying to sort of create a new little niche. Based on a doctrine, though, it is a legal doctrine that is old and well-respected, the public trust doctrine, trying to use it in a kind of a novel way.
The first one that you mentioned, it is certainly probably one of the most important suits, one of the ones at least more people may know about, the one of these 21 young people. I believe it was begun by a young man who was 13 when he started. Now, the Trump administration lawyer on the case is saying that it should not be allowed to proceed because it would disturb the separation of powers as laid out in the Constitution. So explain to us what the opposition is and kind of, you know, where the suit is right now.
Well, right now it is waiting for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to decide whether it goes ahead to its scheduled trial date. The U.S. District Court in Oregon scheduled a trial for February. The Trump administration is trying to derail that as much as possible, tried to dismiss, and that was turned down. So they filed for something called a writ of mandamus, which is a very extraordinary legal move, asking a higher court to dismiss a case or to take a case off before a verdict has been rendered. Now, you have to show something pretty special to get that kind of an order from a higher court. And they just had a hearing last week. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judges seemed very skeptical that this case, there was enough of a reason to derail it before a trial. So we are waiting for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision from last week's hearing of whether the case goes ahead to its scheduled trial or grants the Trump administration argument that it should not go ahead. So the argument that the assistant district attorney made at the hearing was that basically this is not an area for the courts to decide, that this is an area that should be dealt with by the executive and legislative branch. That's who makes policy in this country. And that for the courts to come in and dictate policy is the wrong way to go. So that was his argument. But again, to get what they're requesting right now, which is to derail a case that a U.S. district court has judged should go ahead, to get that off the rails for some extraordinary circumstances, you know, that is considered a long shot to get a panel of judges to agree to that. So we're waiting for that ruling. I think most people expect that that panel will send this forward to its trial. So I don't know at this point, timing-wise, how long all this is going to take and whether or not a February trial is still feasible, but we're still waiting for that ruling.
And in fact, in a rare victory on March 7th of this year, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected the Trump administration's petition for writ of mandamus. October 29, 2018, has been set by the judge as the trial date for that suit. But now to the California case, which just failed. That case brought fossil fuel companies to court under the state's public nuisance law. In this week's ruling, the judge said that the courts were not the proper place to deal with such a global issue as climate change. And he rejected the legal theory put forth by the cities, saying that, quote, the problem deserves a solution on a more vast scale than can be supplied by a district judge or jury in a public nuisance case. But the reason the city sued under the public nuisance law was because a previous lawsuit brought by the Arctic community Kivalina against the companies for causing loss of their land wasn't allowed to be brought in federal court. I asked Lynn Zinser why the Kivalina suit failed and what that had to do with the California case.
Well, it failed because the judges in that case ruled that because they filed in federal court and the body responsible for environmental regulation in this country and climate protection is the Environmental Protection Agency. And so that their responsibility for regulating greenhouse gases and the environment in this country trumps any liability claim against any one particular corporate actor. So that was the decision in that case. It influences a lot of future cases in that some of these current cases, particularly the ones in California, are trying to fight these cases in state courts instead of federal courts so that Kivalina doesn't apply in the state court. So that was the precedent that case created, and it certainly slowed down the ability to pursue these cases in federal court. Of course, times have changed since that ruling, and the Environmental Protection Agency could certainly be accused of not pursuing its legal responsibility for protecting the climate and environment right now. But nobody has brought that case, so certainly that could be coming in the future.
You've mentioned the California cases. These seem to involve the public nuisance law, usually applied to things like, you know, loitering. Tell us about these cases and why they're so important.
Well, they're very important because it's a demonstrated legal avenue, the same legal avenue where California, for instance, holding companies accountable for lead content in paint. That was a public health problem that the suit was brought in California court to address the lead content in paint and the fact that it was harming people and children. Along those lines, using the same line of thinking, if a company is producing a dangerous product, knows it's dangerous, and continues to sell it and contribute to the public health threat, then that company should be held accountable. So it's the same. It's along the same lines. It's the community saying the fossil fuel industry has known for decades that their products contribute to global warming in a significant fashion, continue to sell them, and not only just continue to sell them, but have worked pretty publicly to cast doubt on the science of climate science that their products do contribute to global warming, have worked actively against any kind of climate policy to decrease fossil fuel emissions. So that's part of their argument, too, is not just that they sell these products, but that they've known the dangers and have actually worked against any solutions to those dangers and actively worked against those solutions. So that's, again, using kind of that same, harm and effect line of thinking like you would use for any public health threat, including tobacco, like I said, and lead paint and those kinds of things. So that's certainly the line of thinking of those suits. And there is more and more science that can tie each company or a set of companies to how much global warming they have produced. So that's sort of what is helping these cases, because before it's like, well, yeah, it's happening, but how much is Exxon responsible? You can't really tell, can you? But now that there's science that actually is, you can tie their products and how much has been burned over the years to the global warming that has caused. So that is some of the basis for some of these suits now. They feel like they have much more scientific basis to base these claims on.
And we should point out for our listeners that nearly half of modern global warming has been linked to 90 companies. So is that from the kind of research you're talking about?
Yeah, that's exactly the research. They're called the carbon majors, the 90 primary fossil fuel companies around the world driving, like you said, half of modern global warming. So those numbers have gotten more specific over the years, and in two of the cases in California, the San Francisco and Oakland cases, they're actually just targeting five of the largest So, you know, they're even whittling things down even further. But, yes, it is 90 companies that have been identified as what they call the carbon majors. So that's the significant research that that these cases are leaning on.
That was Lynn Zinser of Climate Liability News. We spoke with her last December. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the whole interview. Last week, we told you about some books publishers sent to us, but that we haven't yet or might not be able to fit into our crowded schedule for air. Here's a few more. Mark Kurlansky is famous for his terrific books about different food stocks, like his books Cod, Salt, and The Big Oyster. He's out with a new one, Milk. It's a story of milk through the ages, told in his classic, entertaining, and informative style. Then, at a time when the lessons of past human rights disasters are vital to inform us about present dangers, comes a book of lessons from Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel's classroom. The title is Witness. It's written by Ariel Berger, who based it on years' worth of journal entries, classroom notes, and interviews with Wiesel's students from all over the world. And finally, The Third Bank of the River is a sweeping look at the war over the Amazon by Chris Feliciano Arnold. It traces the history of the Amazon from the first Spanish conquistadores to the drones now searching out mineral riches to exploit. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Carl Hoffman about his fascinating book, The Last Wild Men of Borneo, A True Story of Death and Treasure, and also with Martin Puchner about his wonderful book, The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.